This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to The State of Health, the podcast where patients put healthcare decision makers and thought leaders in the hot seat. I'm Gunnar Esiason. Today's show carries on the antibiotic resistance series. So far, you've heard from a patient advocate about living with an antibiotic-resistant infection, a politician who is trying to fix the market disincentive at the heart of the crisis. Check your feed to see those episodes. Today, we turn to the business of biotechnology and early-stage investing. Henry Skinner is the CEO of the AMR Action Fund, a novel investment fund with the goal of investing more than $1 billion into small biotech companies hoping to bring novel antibiotics to market. Today, we're going to chat about the steps the AMR Action Fund will take to improve the innovation ecosystem at the heart of antibiotic drug development. Let's talk about the state of antibiotic resistance. All right, Henry, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for the invitation and a pleasure to be here and look forward to it.
So I've been looking forward to this conversation. I am a business student, or well, I guess I was a business student, so I'm definitely enamored with the market issues that are in the antibiotic world, and definitely have been an admirer from afar of the folks who are sort of knee deep in it all. I want to learn more about the AMR Action Fund. What is it, and why is it needed?
Thanks, Gunnar, and thanks again for the invitation. So the AMR Action Fund is a venture fund that was created to address the immediate issues of a lack of investment capital to advance innovative new antibiotics to patients for the treatment of infections caused by drug-resistant pathogens. The fund was formed through a collaboration of the World Health Organization, the Wellcome Trust, the International Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, recognizing that there was a broken market and insufficient capital flowing into this very important area. And so recognizing the need, they came together, conceived of the fund, and now over 20 pharmaceutical companies joined by the Wellcome Trust, the European Investment Bank, the Novo Foundation, the Bangor Ingelheim Foundation, have committed $1 billion to the fund and to this initiative, I think, which is a remarkable statement of the recognition of just how urgent and big the problem is. The fund's goal at the highest level is pretty simple. It's to finance the advancement of 2 to 4 new antibiotics to treat the most urgent drug-resistant infections and to do this by 2030. We will invest in clinical stage biotechnology companies that are developing innovative antibiotics that do treat the most urgent infections around the world caused by priority pathogens, and they've been identified by the World Health Organization and CDC. So this is a very transparent approach to our prioritization. We'll not only invest capital, which is desperately needed, but we will engage collaboratively with the companies to bring scientific, clinical, regulatory, public health know-how to help accelerate the advancement of these urgently needed medicines.
So at the end of the day, it is a venture fund. It's you know, following the venture capital model that exists in biotech. But can you explain how it might be a little different from, you know, what someone might consider to be a traditional biotech venture capital fund?
Absolutely. And I've been making investments in biotechnology venture funds for the past 15 years or so. And it is different in some ways, and it's very, very similar in others. One of the key differences is that traditional venture funds invest across therapeutic areas, across clinical needs, devices, diagnostics, oncology, inflammation, et cetera. We are different chiefly because we focus on drug-resistant infections and developing new antibiotics to the highest clinical need. Other VCs looking at other areas look to optimize their financial returns for those who invest in the VCs. and balance that with high risk opportunities, say in immuno-oncology or genetic diseases or other areas, rather than on purely the clinical need and the medical need for programs. And that, because the market's broken for new antibiotics, they shy away and have not been investing in new antibiotics. Their opportunity for return is simply too much higher in other areas to invest in this. And that's exemplified by a number of things in the broken market, but chiefly over the last few years, we've seen a number of notable bankruptcies, five or six, including Melinta and Acagen, just to name a couple. And it's pretty clear if you're a classic venture capitalist or a traditional venture capitalist investor, where you can invest in any area, that you can't afford to invest in areas that you don't believe have a return because the market's broken. Not because you can't develop good drugs, not because patients don't need them, but because your company would go bankrupt and follow the recent history. And so our approach, to be singularly focused on antibacterial and antifungal new discovery and development for patient benefit allows us to find the best, most interesting priorities to focus on the clinical need and patient benefit and to bring those to market. And that's probably the biggest difference. Otherwise, we're similar. We look at companies the similar way. We try to find the best projects, the best teams, the best entrepreneurs, and the best plan to bring these new drugs to patients.
It would it be fair to say that your appetite for risk or the fund's appetite for risk is a little different than a traditional VC in the sense that, when I think about a different like portfolio approach across different therapeutic areas, like you're diversifying a portfolio, right? But for the AMR Action Fund, it sounds like that's just, it's different in that way.
Well, that's different. It's different in a couple of ways. So you certainly, a traditional fund might diversify by doing some oncology investments, some investments in Alzheimer's, some investments in inflammation or women's health or what have you. But even beyond that, and while we don't look to that, we will diversify in other ways within the field. The chief difference is, I think, that traditional venture funds are looking at recent history, what's hot in the marketplace, what's perceived as being high return potential. And that we're not doing, right? So we've made the strategic decision. We were came to formation to focus on this critical need. And so we're taking as an assumption that the risk of the commercial risk of these products or of our investments in the marketplace is separate from our vision of bringing new products to the market mm-hmm. in this space. And so I guess you might, to phrase it differently, we believe that there needs to be changes to the marketplace in order to drive innovation and bring new products to the market here. I think we're optimistic that happens over the next period of time. I don't know if that's 1 year, 5 years, and when it happens. And if it does, then I think venture capital will flow back into the space. So I think where others are looking at it and saying, we're not going to invest unless we see that change. Mm-hmm. We're investing in advance of that change that we're optimistic comes as a strategic piece of our existence or a piece of our formation. To put it another way, I think the way we came about and the commitment from the pharmaceutical industry, the Wellcome Trust, European Investment Bank, is recognizing the need to society, the need to patients for these new antibiotics, and looking to bridge the gap in time from today when there's not capital being invested here to the policy changes that bring capital back in. And hopefully we, if you will, I don't think it's enough money, but hopefully we buy time for this to happen over the next 1 to 5 years, perhaps, while there's an opportunity. And by doing this, we keep this sector of the industry alive, we keep innovation going, and we move drugs to the benefit of patients through approval while that's happening.
We'll be right back with Henry Skinner. It sounds like you touched on this a little bit, but my next question really for you is, what is the challenge of bringing a new antibiotic to market? And when I think about that question, when I think about, you know, when I wrote that question, my memory goes back to a business school class that I had where we had venture investors, sort of like a panel. And I admittedly asked a loaded question and I said, you know, would your fund ever invest in an antibiotic? And the panelists said, no way in hell we would touch that with a 10-foot pole, in the sense that, you know, the reimbursement risk for a new antibiotic is just so severe that it wasn't for them. And then of course, in the last couple of episodes, we've touched on some of the market disincentives that exist in the antibiotic space. So what really is the challenge facing drug makers in bringing an antibiotic to market and sustainably?
Yeah, I think sustainably is the critical piece and their short-term challenges. But first, you know, there are many of the same challenges we face in this field as in any other field to bring a new drug to market. It's a difficult business. It's full of risk. We know a lot about how to do that, but you know, we need highly efficacious, extremely safe drugs, and that takes some trial and error and clinical studies and you know, phenomenal researchers and drug developers to bring that about. So it's intrinsically risky, in some ways not much different than other fields. And that's fine, right? I think we are comfortable, investors are comfortable in taking that sort of risk and really being pretty effective at finding the best programs to finance and bring forward, all other things being equal. But the challenge is in antibiotics, and you touched on in your question in your class. If there's no market, so if you're successful in bringing it to market and it fits what we need from the standpoint of addressing drug-resistant infections, but the market failures are such that you can't get a return on your investment. In other words, you don't get paid for that success. Venture investors and other investors will not invest if they believe there's zero chance of success, right? Mm-hmm. That risk reward has to be tied together, and it's not in this marketplace for good reasons that we can touch on. I think, you know, we need the new antibiotics, but the challenge is we want, as a society, we want those new antibiotics to be used sparingly. In other words, we want the right antibiotic to be used for a particular patient at a particular point in time that is the right antibiotic for them. Often that's not the latest antibiotic. It's an antibiotic that we might have had for 20, 30, 40 years. And if that's effective, we should use that. And we should hold these new drugs back from their use, because the more we use them, the faster we get drug resistance to the new drugs as well. We will always have this challenge. And so we need good stewardship. In other words, we need this focus of, let's really use the right drug for the right amount of time in the right patient at that moment. The consequence of this is that these new drugs are used sparingly. It's the one field in pharmaceuticals that we as a society don't want these drugs used in maximum volume. We want them used appropriately. But that discordance then is the challenge, right? Most companies make money by finding every patient who will benefit and bringing those drugs that benefit to each of those patients. So your reward is tied to volume. Here, the reward is really, at least in the short term, tied to much less volume, because you're trying to use other things where appropriate. And that benefit for society is achieved over a very long period of time. As resistance gets higher, these drugs get used more. But that might be a decade or two out before you've really, you know, are optimizing or bringing much patient benefit than from a number standpoint as you were the day that you made the antibiotic. But resistance only goes up, and we need them today. There may be fewer patients that need them today than they will be in 10 years. But if we don't find a way to pay for this value, we won't have them when we really need them. And that's really the crux of the problem. So we've got this stewardship issue, which we absolutely want to have. And you could argue across the world, we also have an access issue. So if you think about resistance, it forms when we're not using the right antibiotic. And if we don't have good access to antibiotics around the world, resistance will rise in places that are using old and tired antibiotics inappropriately. And that resistance comes around the world in fairly short order. We've certainly seen what happens with mutations and the spread of them with COVID. And the same thing happens with pathogens as well. And so we need to stay ahead of it, and we have that challenge. But the net sum is we need to find a way to reward innovation in the space and to bring the needed drugs to market in a way that recognizes the value to society in the long run and the appropriateness of its use in the short run. In other words, let's bring the benefit to patients for today and tomorrow and invest in that infrastructure, if you will, of treating infections for the long-term benefit of society. So that's really the biggest challenge we have. And that market failure ends up in a vicious cycle that now investors won't invest in the space because there's no way to make money in it. And so they invest in other opportunities in autoinflammation, arthritis, you know, needed things. But the dearth of investment is a great risk for us here. It will strangle innovation. It will lead to few, if any, new antibiotics approved. And in the long run, that's going to be very detrimental. Already, we have 35 to 50,000 people in each the US and Europe that die of these infections a year, over 700,000 a year around the globe, and projections of as many as 10 million a year by 2050, which is not too far out. And if this continues to grow, the cost to society is huge. And given right. that it takes 10 to 15 years to develop a new antibiotic, we have to stay ahead of it, and we have to be a decade or two ahead of when the need is acute and urgent and significant.
And, I think for health policy nerds like myself, having read Jim O'Neill's the review on antimicrobial resistance, a lot of those themes sort of, resurface themselves over and over again. But I want to talk about the AMR Action Fund's place inside the biopharma and innovation ecosystem. Talked about how pharma companies are either partners with the AMR Action Fund via funding or just tangentially. Why aren't, and maybe you've touched this a little bit, but why aren't pharma companies just using their corporate venture arms to do this work? Like why are they putting this onto the AMR Action Fund as a sort of an independent fund?
Yeah. So I think, I guess I would probably start by saying, I'm not sure pharma companies aren't using their corporate venture arms to do this work. But the inverse is, if I look back in time and I was in corporate venture some years ago and led deals in the space, and I was joined by other corporate venture funds in investing in antibiotic companies. So it's not necessarily that they're not, but they're not singularly focused on it. And each company who has the venture arm invests in different ways, often strategically to the company. And if the company is in AMR work, that's great. If they're not, it's a bit out of subject matter for that particular fund. More importantly, I think with the AMR Action Fund, because we're focused on this and because we've been able to secure commitments to $1 billion, we're able to bring a particular focus to AMR activity. So we are developing and building a scientific advisory board that will be unparalleled in venture in this field, whereas other SABs and other venture groups have broad, and rightly so, a broad diversity of experience and expertise that may touch on AMR. Ours is singularly focused on that. And so, both the amount of capital and the focus, I think, is a key driver that allows, much more effective engagement than individual pharma companies doing individual things with their corporate venture arms. And I'm not sure that there won't be opportunities to co-invest with them. I hope there are. We're looking for co-investors when we make investments. But I think our singular focus and the amount of capital is substantially different than trying to leverage individual corporate arms that also do other things.
You make an interesting point there, saying that the fund is building scientific expertise in the field that's unparalleled. And I think a lot about, the world that I know, right? The CF Foundation does their own venture work. They have a venture philanthropy model. And I see the value, of course, to their work as, of course, the financing they provide, but also the infrastructure that they provide too, right? If an idea makes it through the gauntlet of cystic fibrosis, researchers and scientific expertise, like that is a signal that the technology might actually work and open up the floodgates for further investment that are from firms that are like bringing the real money to move these ideas forward. And I definitely hear that parallel there. And I guess that leads into my next question. What is going to be the strength of the AMR Action Fund? And maybe you've already answered it.
In part, I think I have. So I think the focus is the strength, the amount of committed capital behind us is the strength. Our SAB and other capabilities we're building focused on this is going to bring a lot more than capital into the portfolio companies we're investing in. And frankly, companies overall, we look to engage broadly in the field and talk to, you know, everyone ideally as we try to find those companies we'll invest in. But we will bring obviously the capital and investment, but we will also bring intellectual capability. You know, what is the right study to do? And to your parallel to see a foundation, I think that's great. I hope we bring that kind of credibility, but we will bring know-how as to where to go, who were the right contract research organizations, manufacturers, et cetera. Where is the intellectual expertise to address particular problems that is faced in the development of new anti-infective drugs? So all of that, I think, is going to be our strength. I think our linkage into the pharmaceutical industry is an opportunity as well. There's enormous know-how within the industry, biotech and pharma, that is a potential to tap into to help the innovation across the field wherever problems arise. And so I think those are critical strengths. Again, our focus is, and $1 billion is a good chunk of capital where I think the opportunity to maybe help bring other venture groups back into this field, we can catalyze as well. So if we're right and we're forward thinking and that some of these macro market challenges get fixed, we think we can bring others back in. And in the short term, you know, others coming in with some trepidation that the growing financial need as the company's advanced through clinical studies from the early to the late, it's an opportunity where I think our $1 billion can give them comfort. They're not going to be left hanging with, you know, on a pier, not quite getting to the other side of the river. So I think that helps as well. And is an aspect of an opportunity that we can add to the discussion as well.
So let's look forward a little bit. Is the fund going to consider investment into technologies that don't represent, you know, the classic antibiotic as we think of them? And are there any other antibacterial technologies that you have your eye on? You know, maybe either non-traditional or sort of novel in the way they work.
Yeah, I think we want to take a broad look. My focus has always been thinking about the patient first. I don't think patients need to be treated. They need to have their disease cured, their infection cured. And if that's a pill or an injection or what have you, I think it matters fairly little. I think that's going to be our approach as well. Traditional approaches have given fabulous 80 years of success and really a golden age of antibiotics to, you know, transformative patient benefit. If you go back to before antibiotics in the 30s and 40s, a simple operation was that significant risk of infection and death or sepsis. And we take for granted some of the benefits that antibiotics provide. It probably adds 8 or 10 years to the average life expectancy from all those things. So, you know, I think we should not be blind to simply the old way. New ways offer a lot of promise. If you think about resistance and we've looked a lot at how resistance forms and what kind of resistance tends to be carried forward, you know, all the old approaches are resistance approaches by microorganisms to all of them. And so new approaches offer an escape from that, at least for a period of time, and maybe a little more time before resistance comes. Additionally, new approaches may give us new entrees to treat new infections in a better way. There's certainly plenty of very difficult to treat infections that new approaches might be particularly amenable to, and not just complementary to what we have and perhaps synergistic. So I don't want to be too limiting in that at all. We are looking at atypical approaches, some of which have been around a long time and have shown great anecdotal success. And we'll look to think, how can we move these forward in appropriate clinical studies that really prove their utility? Things such as phage, lysins, antibodies, et cetera. And that's just to name a few, and I don't mean to be exclusive to others. Each of them deserves a good hard look and understanding of how to progress them, where their patient benefit is, and then how do you prove that, and how does it fit in within the use of the other antibiotics. But we're not going to be focused on any one approach, but rather all approaches. And again, what gives us the greatest opportunity to provide the clinical benefit we need to see against these infections, not what's the easiest path or anything else, but what is the greatest opportunity for clinical benefit?
So let's move to some more macro level stuff here as we sort of wind down this podcast episode. Do you think the AMR Action Fund and the AMR Action Fund's being represents a shift in the way the biopharmaceutical industry is looking at antibiotics, or even maybe more broadly, the way, you know, society is looking at this issue?
I hope we will be a catalyst or a group that helps bring attention to this. I think, you know, this has been a pandemic that's been going on for an awfully long time. And I think we take for granted the utility of antibiotics, and we just assume that all the benefits we have are going to continue to exist in the future, but it won't without really focused effort and new antibiotics coming to market. So I don't know if we represent that shift yet. I hope we're a leading indicator of that shift and help catalyze some of that shift. I think the industry, the scientists, the entrepreneurs, physicians and clinicians, you know, recognize the challenge, want to be active in the area, want to develop new drugs. And I think the hindrance has just been capital over the last decade or even more. And I think if we can help bring attention to that, we can help catalyze the changes that need to be put in place around the world to reinvigorate that market, then the shift will be accelerated and absolute. I think until that happens, you know, there's more attention. I think COVID has reminded us as to the impact pandemics can have. The difference is that the AMR pandemic is slow burning. It's slowly ramping up, and sometimes it's hard to notice a fire that's out of control and the wind is not blowing in your direction yet. And so we get complacent, and I think that's how it's been. So I hope the answer is yes, this is just a leading indicator of much change.
The State of Health, we'll be right back. You know, I think you said something a little profound, but I want to make sure I can highlight it for our listeners. You said that people might be taking for granted, you know, the utility that and the benefit that antibiotics provide in the here and now. And I think that's something that I've certainly seen in my own life, right? I, of course, coming on the entire other end of the spectrum here, you know, having lived with a resistant infection and going through the conversations that, you know, lead me to understand why I'm losing different antibiotic options or why I only have so many left. And I think that's a profound thing because it's a complex issue, right? The market issue is complex. Not everyone understands how reimbursement for drugs works in the United States, or even how investment strategies bring drugs to patients, right? It's a very long process. It's one that's not exactly in the public eye. And then you compound that with the very unique way that antibiotics work and lose efficacy over time. That when you start adding all these things up together, you have just like this giant mess of an issue that you need to pull apart one string at a time. And I think that's where a lot of the, you know, at least urgency from my perspective is lost. And I'd be curious to you know, maybe get some comments why you think this is something that maybe not necessarily happening underneath the table, but is sort of festering before it boils over.
I think that there's been a number of reasons. I think a number of things have come together. Some unintended consequences of some policies that were put in place that disincentivize hospitals from maybe using the latest antibiotic that might be most appropriate for a patient with DRGs. And I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but there's been a number of headwinds or impediments to it. The lack of a market, the bankruptcies, et cetera, have all conspired to expose the challenges we face, and you know, difficult, risky drug discovery on top of that, and really so much innovation in other areas that that doesn't have those impediments, that's drawn capital away. So you combine all of those things together, and that's where we are today. I think, you know, the analogy is if we think about our infrastructure and roads and bridges, have a bridge across a major river. It was built in the 1950s, and antibiotics came out. You need to constantly maintain that, right? You need to invest in repainting it and repaving it and making sure it's in good shape. And at some point in time, you may have to replace it. And so that investment over decades is the same thing that we need here. And if you don't invest in it, these things crumble and collapse and drop into the river. And then you realize that the crisis you're in and the cost of replacing it and the cost to society is immense in that period of time as you're rushing to fix it. A similar analogy is, looking at COVID and the phenomenal success and rescue really we've had from it through the vaccine work. Those vaccines weren't created overnight. It took a year of remarkable work by the companies and scientists. But you need to think back, it was probably a decade or more of research and work and investment into the technologies that enabled the vaccines to be potentially useful here and applied, through enormous work over the years since. If we didn't have that investment over the 10 years before, we wouldn't be where we are now. And thank goodness we had that investment, to be able to come out of this. But, I think that's really how one needs to think about it, is investment in the infrastructure of healthcare that you need to make to maintain the quality that we have in the system. And if we don't invest in that, the quality will decline, and the human consequence to that is great. People will die and do die today that, if we do what we need to do here, we can reduce that dramatically, mm-hmm. not only in the US, but around the world.
That's certainly the main goal. And in a similar vein, and my last question for you here today is, what does the AMR Action Fund need to achieve to mean that it was a success?
Yeah, I think that to me is multifactorial. As I look ahead some years, there's a number of things I'd like to see achieved, not only by us, by society broadly, by policymakers and governments around the world and scientists and the like. So many are beyond our direct control, but I think critically important to me personally, to us as a society and to patients today and in the future. Maybe the first one is this, I expect we will have financed and brought to approval 2 to 4 and I think probably more new antibiotics and begin to see their impact on patients in treating drug-resistant infections, saving many lives and providing much needed benefit to patients, their families, and society. I think it's notable as we think about that success and as I think about it and look forward, these benefits accrue for many decades. They're not just short term. Each of these new antibiotics will have increasing benefit over time and benefit not only us today, but next generations to come, just as the current generation of antibiotics have. We do need to remember that benefit is not forever, and we need a steady state, sustainable environment to continue to drive innovation so that we always have the next needed antibiotic. So that's the first one. I think probably the other really important one, maybe more important in some ways, is I want to see that we've catalyzed needed market reforms such that investment capital flows again naturally into AMR research and development from venture capital firms, public markets, et cetera. And through that, we've created and reinvigorated a steady state, incentive for investment and innovation that drives the future new antibiotic development and brings patient benefit forward perpetually. And that sustainable environment really is the critical thing to treat new emergent infections that will continue to crop up. You know, I think another important thing as I look forward, thinking I'm looking back, is that through our investment that we've also kept our scientists engaged, that we've facilitated the training of the next generation of scientists in this field to continue to develop the needed drugs we have here, and that we do that before our current generation retires and their collective knowledge is lost. That's another thing that worries me. As I look back in my career, 15 or 20 years ago, I was involved at Pharmacy and Upjohn, who developed Zyvox, which has been a great drug for gram-positive infection. And most of my colleagues who were active in that are either retired or nearing retirement. And if we don't continue to invest in the space, we'll lose that knowledge. And those individuals won't be able to transfer their knowledge to the next generation. And we're going to make it that much harder for us to continue to develop the drugs we desperately need here. So I think that there's an urgency to that. And if I look forward 6 or 8 or 10 years looking back, I hope that we're able to facilitate that continued training and bringing new, young, brilliant scientists into the field and not have them do other things. That again, is important, but to the detriment of new anti-infectives. I'd like to see better stewardship and access programs throughout the world, really, again, focused on bringing the right drug to the patient at the right moment in time in order to effectively treat the infection, number one, and number two, to try to limit the spread of resistance and the growth of resistance around the world. And I think those things are inextricably linked. Now that's gonna take a global effort, has a lot of challenges to it in low and middle income countries, but I think is quite important. I'd like to see the low and middle countries find a way to better utilize our clinical trials in those environments as well. This is where there's a fairly high degree of resistance, and yet they don't have the infrastructure to participate in clinical trials and helping to develop the desperately needed antibiotics that are to come. And then the last piece I think I'd like to see is I have a fairly extensive list here, but I think they're all interrelated into creating an ecosystem that maximizes the value of the antibiotics from the standpoint of patient benefit, minimizes future resistance and the like. But we need a really good comprehensive surveillance system of resistance across the globe. And through that, we'll know what's coming, right? What sort of stewardship and access can minimize that, and to identify for future drug development the highest priorities of where research is needed to have the greatest impact. And I don't think we do a good job of that, not as well as we should around the globe. And, we see that in COVID as well. There's certainly some places that have a lot more understanding of how mutations are forming and others less so. And the more of that we have, I think the better we are positioned to stay ahead of things. And so that's the last piece of these interrelated things that to maximize our benefit to patients in the long, long run.
So, yeah, I think
it's a long list, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's a comprehensive list is what it is, right? From the steady stream of antibiotics that are coming in a functional marketplace, trial infrastructure in the underdeveloped world, scientists as a resource, something that I personally never thought about before. I think I'm always thinking about patients as a resource for clinical trials, but you have, further upstream, you've got the scientists that are doing the basic lab work as a resource in the labs. And then, of course, the macro level surveillance, which, certainly is evident that it wasn't in place for us to catch COVID in time. And I think certainly something that we're still working through. And I think those are some lofty goals. And, consider this patient on this side of the microphone as someone who's rooting for the AMR Action Fund to to play its part and its valuable role in achieving those. But Henry, I want to say thank you for coming on the show today. This has been great, and I've enjoyed this trip down what it takes to bring an antibiotic to market.
Thanks, Gunnar. Thanks much again for the chance to have the discussion, and very much look forward to continuing it.
That's all for this week. Be sure to join us next week. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at G17Esiason, and you can check out my website at gunnaresiason.com. The Antibiotic Resistance Series continues next week. If you liked what you heard today, be sure to subscribe to The State of Health and then leave a rating and a review. A big thank you to Henry Skinner and the AMR Action Fund for today's interview. State of Health is produced by Bob Dwyer. Thanks to Odyssey for making this podcast possible. We'll see you next week.